Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Across the country, headlines in newspapers read, Trump impeached again. Yesterday, for the first time in our nation's history, a president was impeached for the second time. And for the first time in our nation's history, a president was impeached for inciting insurrection against his own country. The last 7 days have marked a low point in our history. First, violence in the Capitol, and now the indictment of a president who incited unrest after lying about winning in a landslide, an election that he clearly lost. This doesn't happen in America, but it did. So this is who we are. This is what we've come to. And although President Trump has characterized as totally appropriate the remarks he made that inspired insurrectionists to storm the cradle of our democracy, resulting in the loss of 5 lives, the majority of the country disagrees, as do Democrats in Congress, along with an increasing number of Republicans. There is no chance that the Senate will hold a trial before a new president is inaugurated, and the likelihood of conviction seems slim. So what does this impeachment accomplish? Is this the right response? How do you hold accountable elected officials from the president on down, including those who supported him and helped spread falsehoods about a stolen election? To help us through that discussion, we welcome Dr. Susan Roberts to our microphones, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Welcome back.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Dr. Eric Heberle, professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. Good to see you again, Eric.
Morning, Mike.
And Asher Hildebrand is an associate professor of the practice in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Thank you for joining us as well. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Susan, let me start with you. This is the second impeachment of this president. The first one resulted in no conviction. And though the mood is changing with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying he is pleased with impeachment in the House, believing it will be easier to purge Donald Trump from the party, conviction this time is also unlikely, at least it is at this point. What then is the point of what happened yesterday?
Well, I think the point is something had to be done. This was incitement of insurrection. And if you look back, say, with Clinton and some other things, those were really almost petty in relationship to what went on here. And I think that it was beyond symbolic. And it was symbolic, but I feel like people thought, as one of the representatives that voted against the Republicans, she said, it's not partisan, it's not ideological, it's not my conscience, I'm voting the truth. And so I think it needed to be done for the people, the representatives who said, we can't ignore this, and we may not get Trump convicted, but it has to be done. And I think when we look back, and some of the things we're talking about are things in history, and precedent is very important for the presidency, because the end there is very small, and you can't do regression analysis on the presidency.
Eric, following the first impeachment with no conviction, President Trump pointed to the result not just as a victory, but as an exoneration and proof of his unjustified claim that what preceded that impeachment was, in fact, a witch hunt. He's already begun using that phrase again this time. It's a witch hunt. It's a hoax. Won't this impeachment, in the absence of another conviction, solidify that claim, both in his mind, but also, more importantly, I guess, in the minds of followers of the president in and out of Congress, some of whom demonstrated their willingness to overturn this election to keep him in office? Won't it say to them, you were right?
President Trump has done very well over the years in making himself a victim, making his supporters into victims of the elite of the establishment. So there's no doubt he has a talent for making what most of us would consider terrible personal situations and making it work in a marketing sense for himself. So I think part of the task here is to not make this about Donald Trump per se, than to say, what does this say about us and our political system? that what are our standards, what is a high crime and misdemeanor, and when someone has crossed the line of threatening the stability of American government, are we willing to stand up and say so, even if some people might make this into a political benefit for themselves over the long term? And likewise, the fact that he's leaving office, well, the typical punishment is not there, but the Senate can impose a punishment of barring him from running for office in the future, which the Constitution clearly specifies. But I think the main point, to elaborate on what Susan said, is to set this as a precedent. If we allow this to go, there will be politicians in the future and lawyers in the future who will point to this event and say, Donald Trump did X, Y, and Z and wasn't punished for it. Therefore, I can do it too. And they'll take it totally out of context and allow for even worse behavior in the future. So I think it's very important that we call a spade what it is and act appropriately, even if the punishment isn't what it would have been a year or two ago.
And I suppose it could be argued to people who still support the president that the next time this happens, if it were to happen again and this precedent weren't set, it might be on the other side and you may not like it so much. Asher, the vice president, was urged prior to all of this to invoke, in fact, he was given an ultimatum to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove the president from office, or else we would go to this impeachment. He decided not to do that. Was that a mistake?
Well, I think it was certainly a striking example of Vice President Pence's peculiar brand of loyalty to the president that he served with, given the very real threats that his life was under during the Capitol siege. Whether it was a mistake or not, I think it's certainly true that many in Congress, Democrats included, had hoped that the vice president would invoke that constitutional option. It was certainly a murkier path in terms of the reasons the 25th Amendment was ratified and whether those reasons would apply this time, whereas impeachment is kind of was a clear-cut case, so to speak. But I don't think Democrats in Congress were relishing the prospect of having to conduct an impeachment trial and vote so close to a contested election or so close to the inauguration of a new president. I think they truly saw this as a last resort, given the unwillingness of the vice president to pursue the 25th Amendment option.
I don't have any lawyers on the panel this morning, but there is some question about whether or not the 25th Amendment could have been legally invoked, given the number of cabinet resignations we have and the number of acting cabinet members who were never confirmed by the Senate. Could that have become a sticky wicket if the vice president had invoked it?
Well, certainly. I mean, the 25th Amendment was ratified after the Kennedy assassination, contemplating a situation where a president was incapacitated physically. Now, many scholars believe that Trump probably rose to the level of incapacitation, but it was certainly a stickier wicket, as you say, whereas impeachment was a clear-cut case. And I'll just add that, complementing what Susan and Eric said, I mean, the purpose of accountability and the principle that was at stake here is not just to hold President Trump accountable and punish him for behavior that clearly rose to the level of the high crimes and misdemeanors envisioned in the Constitution, but also to deter both President Trump in his remaining days in office from additional conduct and to deter future presidents who might consider this. So there was a lot at stake here, even though it feels just totally insane to be pursuing this in the waning days of an administration. There were some extremely consequential principles at stake, and the House felt like it had no choice but that.
And I guess, Eric, coming back to what you said a little while ago about the need to set a precedent so that if this ever occurs again, there will be precedent to point to, does that strengthen the argument that we should not have waited for a Merrick Garland Justice Department to come in and launch a criminal prosecution against President Trump if he chose to do so once the new administration comes in? It's better to do an impeachment because that sets a precedent, or could he have set the precedent?
Well, I think those are two separate tracks. And I think once you get into a legal criminal issue, you really have very different standards. Then we're debating over, well, what is really an insurrection? What is really incitement? What are the legal standards here for punishing someone? Where impeachment is just high crimes and misdemeanors, which is a very flexible standard for Congress to use. So I think either of those are appropriate in this case. And, any legal repercussions are really outside of Congress's ability to deal with. They have the power of impeachment. So I think it was entirely appropriate that they move, regardless of what other potential avenues are out there for the political system as a whole to address this behavior.
If you follow all this, Susan, and I know you do, reporters who cover the White House and Congress have been saying now for years that behind the scenes, Republicans at all levels of government have an extreme distrust of and dislike of the president because of how he acts and what he's done to the Republican Party. And we know that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell just said that this gives them an opportunity to purge Donald Trump from the party, which also opens doors to people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley to run for president next time, because if Donald Trump is not prohibited from running again, he could run again and probably would certainly commandeer the party again. So that didn't seem to gain much traction in the House yesterday. Why?
Well, and let me just say one more thing to Eric's point about criminal versus impeachment, and that is, this was not looked on as a legal crime, but as Liz Cheney said, it was a crime against the office of the president and the duty to the Constitution. I mean, we have not just the actions of the president, but as everybody said, democracy on trial. That's a very different standard. But one of the reasons to your question that I think that many of the Republicans did not go on board is that in the House, is that they're still afraid of not being elected to office. And if you teach Congress, you know that, as Mayhew said, members of Congress are single-minded seekers of re-election. And one thing, if it doesn't come up, this is why I would take a bet on the fact that Trump will not be convicted. And that is, there are 34 seats up for re-election, Senate seats, in 2022. 14 of them are Democrats and 20 are Republicans. And in 2022, this hangover of Trump and of what happened, and you have Jim Jordan on the floor wanting Liz Cheney to be stripped of her rank in Congress, that doesn't speak to me to bipartisanship. And I don't think that that standard of saying, we'll see what's good and our duty and I'm worried about unity and all these things. I think reporters do realize that members of Congress want to be reelected, and they're going to try to hang on by looking at Trump, and their behavior for the last 4 years has been tied, as anyone would say, to a loyalty to Donald Trump, or at least a tacit loyalty. I don't know what is in their hearts.
Yeah. And of course, there is this strain of Trumpism that it's connected to Trump, but he doesn't have to be there to perpetuate it. And we now have a significant number of people in the House, at least, who fall into that category. And we have some QAnon people in the House, which is a whole different story. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about differing truths. We don't see things the same way anymore, and what that means for the future, and what it meant for yesterday, and what it means for the trial in the Senate when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the events in the House yesterday where they impeached Donald Trump for the second time, this time encouraging insurrection. Susan Roberts is here, professor of political science at Davidson College. Eric Heberle, professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. And Asher Hildebrand, associate professor of The Practice, not the TV show, at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. We seem to have two, I'm not sure they believe it, but maybe they do, but we have two versions of the truth here and two points of view on what happened both last week and how we should handle a rogue president, if that's in fact what he is. And yesterday, we heard all these stories about picking on Donald Trump, and we've been picking on, and the Democrats have been picking on Donald Trump since he was elected. Yesterday, Congressman Louie Gohmert accused Speaker Nancy Pelosi of wielding impeachment as a weapon to be used on a whim. Is that something, Susan, that reasonable Americans would agree with?
I think if you look back election after election, Nancy Pelosi has been the target for Republicans. And so there are many people that take her as a villain. But I don't think many people would consider it a whim. I actually, watching it last night, there was supposed to be an upcoming news conference with Nancy Pelosi. She announced the articles and she left. She did not elaborate. People were shouting questions. And I think if she had wanted to make it whimsical, she has done some things in the past, you know, tearing up the State of the Union address and things that did look to be, disrespectful or tacky or whatever you want to call it. That was not Nancy Pelosi yesterday. I think it does sadden the hearts of anyone if you can get beyond partisanship. And that's what everyone, every Republican on the House spoke to. We need bipartisanship. And so I took her at a word. I think it was sad.
I think the idea of her tearing up the State of the Union speech behind the president came up yesterday from one congressman. It could have been Jim Jordan, I'm not sure. But also yesterday, Asher, during that impeachment debate, Jim Jordan did make the argument that this impeachment is another example of a Democratic obsession, his words, to get the president, also his words. Other Republicans followed suit with similar allegations. Certainly a political point of view, I suppose, but isn't this thrust toward evicting Trump different simply because of what we witnessed last week, both on the Ellipse and at the Capitol building?
Absolutely. And the first thing I'd say is that as far as I'm concerned, elected officials who aided and abetted Trump's two-month quest to overturn the results of a free and fair election, and in some cases, as more evidence comes out, appear to have even participated in some way in what happened on January 6th, don't have a whole lot of moral standing to talk about unity and politicization. Now, that said, I think there are two competing principles at stake here. Of course, impeachment is the ultimate last resort in our constitutional democracy and should be wielded with extreme care by our elected leaders. And anything that puts it on a slippery slope to being invoked anytime there's political disagreement is something that we have to think very carefully about. On the other hand, imagine the principle if Congress had not acted at all, given the facts of the case and given what happened. This was not just a violent insurrection against government generally. This was a violent insurrection against Congress, the legislative branch. And for that branch of government not to hold accountable those who perpetrated it and those who incited it would also set an extremely damaging principle. So I think Speaker Pelosi and others in the House had to weigh those two principles and just decided that one very clearly won out here.
It's a sad thing, but it seems to me that down through history, politics and politicians have a close association with hypocrisy. they seem to be able to feed it to the public with very few of any consequences. And yesterday, I think, was a good example. You just mentioned, Asher, the call for unity coming from people who, even after the insurrection in the Capitol, voted to overturn or object to legal votes in states, saying that they needed investigation because there was major fraud, when there have been absolutely no indications of that. 50 courts around America have said no. There is no indication, there is no proof, there has been no evidence presented that this election was fraudulent in any way. And in fact, Donald Trump's own Homeland Security person, I believe, said at some point in the last couple of weeks that this was the most secure election in American history. When you have that many members of Congress, Eric, of a political party refusing to tell their constituents the truth about something as important as this, what do we do?
I just want to point out that this is almost standard political rhetoric, that if you can't defend the behavior on your own side, you try to shift the guilt onto the other side. You say, well, they did something similar at some other time in the future, even or in the past, even if it's totally out of context, or also what was happening yesterday. If you can't win on the substance, you shift to the process. You say, well, his behavior was bad, but we shouldn't rush this. We should have hearings. We should have due process. You make it about something else rather than the point you can't win on.
But this is this is not politics as usual. This was an armed insurrection aimed at people in the Capitol trying to do the government's work, the people's work. And people's lives were at stake and five lives were lost. And it could have been much, much worse. Can't they
see this? For elected officials, though, unfortunately, it is politics as usual. That they feel or they do what they think they need to do to appeal to the voters who are going to reelect them, which because of the way we've sorted ourselves politically means you're appealing mostly to the party base rather than the average moderate voter in the middle. And we've seen that consistently across Trump's presidency, that many of the politicians we've criticized for, quote unquote, enabling the president got elected overwhelmingly. Lindsey Graham is a good example. He's been criticized for, well, he nuked the president when they were running against one another in the Republican primaries, then became his best friend. Well, which is it? Well, he won overwhelmingly, and now he's kind of shifted a little bit back to criticizing the president again. Is he consistent? Oh, is he successful as a politician? Very much so.
But I want to go ahead, Asher. Go ahead.
Senator Graham also saying he will lead the opposition to impeachment in the Senate, even despite his criticism of the president. So it's kind of hard to pin down exactly which way he's wavering on any given day.
But my point is, it's working for him.
Well, that's a sad comment, because it seems to me this is not normal politics. This is something far, far, far more important and more dangerous. And yesterday, Republican pollster Frank Luntz spoke with Trump voters, and he released these results. 78% of Republican voters believe that the election was stolen from Trump. 61% say they will never again trust the results of an American election. 64% said that the American way of life is disappearing so fast that they may have to use force to save it. I'm not sure what the American way of life means, but and who is responsible? He asked, who is responsible for the violence at the Capitol last week? These are Republican voters. 28% said Antifa. 17% blamed it on the Democrats. Trump supporters were blamed by 13%, the news media 11%, Donald Trump 11%. Going back to the 61% who will never again trust the results of an American election, does that figure into whatever kind of accountability comes out of this for those who lied repeatedly about these election results being rigged and stolen? Haven't they poisoned faith in American democracy, aside from inciting and taking part in civil unrest, Susan?
I sure think so. And one of the reasons is, if you look year after year after year, we've had a decline in Americans' trust in government to do the right thing. And that's not just yesterday or a week ago, or in the face of something that happened in terms of impeachment or the Electoral College. So it was already low. It's almost like limbo. How low can you go? And I'm not sure that those numbers, if you look at some numbers from Axios, they showed that a Trump supporter felt over 90% that he should be a candidate, that the Electoral College votes were fraudulent. And, you know, who knows, how do we define a Trump supporter? Clearly, the extremists, the anarchists that attacked the Capitol were, you know, they were incited and agitated by Trump. Now, they're extremist in that group, and we're already having rumors that there was collusion with members of Congress and the Capitol Police. We're in the period now, it's just been a week, that people are starting to have rumors. Oh, I think Trump will pardon all the insurrectionists. I think when I was answering a question earlier about Nancy Pelosi, I have to go back and think about did I use the word Nancy Pelosi has been a target for the Republicans for decades? And you know what? I don't want to use the word target anymore because I think that has changed in our vocabulary about what that might mean. Looking over the tapes again, they're even more disturbing when you see the gangs going heave, ho, heave, ho. That's not who Republicans are, but that's part of the Trump base. And I think this will be, I agree with Frank Luntz. He's very even-handed in his polling. He's a Republican consultant, but he knows what a good poll is. He knows how to conduct a legitimate poll. And not having trust in government is a sad thing. And the ideological clustering that we have, the extremes of polarization, and I also wish I had another word for polarization, those aren't going away with impeachment hearings. Those are really reflected in that distrust in government.
Asher, you served for nearly 15 years in Congress. You were chief of staff for the North Carolina Congressman David Price. How have we arrived at a place where we have two political parties with absolutely different points of view, not only on events that happen around them, like insurrections, but the actual definition of truth? How did we get here? How can you operate a country with that?
How much time do you have?
23 minutes.
Answer. No, don't answer. Look, I used to give a fairly standard answer to that question, which is that many members of Congress and their staff are fundamentally decent and rational people who are responding to a set of incentives that's become skewed by the media, by money in politics, and by the electorate, it must be said, in terms of how Americans have self-sorted themselves into different districts. Not to mention the reinforcing effects of redistricting and the fact that many members are now far more accountable to the most extreme elements of their base than they are to the so-called median voter. So that was my standard answer, and that's still true. But I just feel like after the events of the last 4 years and the events of the last week, we've got to find a place for personal accountability. The nature of leadership is to rise above those incentives and do the right thing. And it feels right now that there are many members of Congress who are simply not doing that. And we've got to find a way to hold them accountable, too, for their personal decisions.
Eric, people have said that people like Josh Hawley in the Senate and Ted Cruz should be expelled from the Senate for their continued telling of falsehoods about the validity of the vote. What should be done? Well, not only about them, but other people who continue to deny the validity of the vote and who seem to back away from admitting that what happened last week was an attempted coup.
Expulsions are extremely rare, so I wouldn't expect that to happen. But I do think it is very worthwhile to debate whether it is appropriate in this situation. Even having the debate is a means of holding those people accountable and pointing out that their behavior was wrong and setting that precedent and standard that it doesn't happen again. It provides information for their constituents that their constituents can take into account if that person should seek office again. It certainly provides information that their local media and potential challengers in the future can use to try to hold them accountable. So I definitely think it is a conversation worth having, even if no result follows from it in terms of the member being removed from office. I also think we've seen this week that a number of donors are stepping back and saying, we don't want to fund people who did this. That's another clear signal to politicians of the way the incentive structure is changing. I don't think political action committee funding is terribly important in Senate races, but I think it's really the signal that the community is sending that this is not appropriate behavior that's more important than any $5,000 contribution.
Steve Schmidt, who is a former Republican strategist and who is now one of the founders of the Lincoln Project, which is virulently anti-Trump, says we are witnessing an autocratic movement led by Donald Trump and abetted by members of the Republican Party. He says, quote, if we lose another national election to members of this movement, it will be our last election. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman says, as long as the GOP is Donald Trump's party, it must not be given power again. Is that hyperbole, Susan?
No, I don't. Steve Schmidt's gotten very agitated lately, but he always gives reasoned arguments. And I think when you look back, and as Eric brought up, you know, what you can do to punish or expel members, there's now, and it's symbolic, but are we hitting politicians where they live? And that is being reelected and getting contributions. And it may only be temporary, but that is symbolic that some of our politicians, and I will also say some of our public servants, because there may or may not still be a distinction. But I think the anti-Trumpers, there's a new group defending democracy together, or some umbrella group that is pledging $50 million to defend those members who voted to the Republicans that voted to impeach Trump. And that's a sad state of affairs. But I think that Republicans going forward are going to have to say, what is a traditional Republican? Mitt Romney, the ghost of John McCain, or is it more extremism? And I think that's something that the Republicans are going to have to reckon with. There's, you know, there are fractures in every party, both parties, but how is the Republican Party going to conduct itself going forward? Who are the new members? How will they deal with the extremist? And Kevin McCarthy on the floor yesterday said that it is not true that this was the work of Antifa.
Finally.
Yeah.
He and others also said that Joe Biden officially won the election. Finally. So we'll talk more about this clear divide, grievances on the left and right, and how, where we go from here when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what happened yesterday, how we got there, where we go from here in terms of impeachment and the reconstruction of our political system, essentially, with Dr. Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, Eric Heberling, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and Asher Hildebrand, associate professor of the practice at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. I want to read an email that came in from Kirby. Madison Cawthorn, who's the newly elected district representative from North Carolina, on election night tweeted out, "Cry more, Lib." On December 21st, he said, "Lightly threaten Congress and tell them I'm coming for you." On the day of the insurrection, he said, "The battle is on the House floor. They are trying to silence your voice. Yesterday, he said, "I urge my colleagues to vote against this divisive impeachment and realize that divided America will not save this republic." Back in an earlier time, a more innocent time, a more pacifistic time, politicians were criticized for being flip-floppers. Is he flip-flopping? Is he prevaricating? Is he trying to wiggle out of a situation that he helped create? Asher.
Well, I grew up in Asheville and met my wife working on a campaign for the district that Representative Cawthorn now holds. So this one's kind of near and dear to my heart. I think he is both the poster child for Trumpism without Trump, or at least that's his aspiration. But he's also a case study for the very question you posed. How do we hold members of Congress accountable for their behavior, especially someone like Representative Cawthorn, who has admitted to carrying a loaded gun into the Capitol during the insurrection, has admitted to going door to door to senators, asking them to overturn the votes of the election, and of course told supporters in December, as you said, that they should lightly threaten their members of Congress. Of course, we've got an electoral process for that. And while the 11th district is a Republican district, I expect it will get a lot of attention from prospective candidates next year. But in terms of his actual floor statements yesterday, I see them more as the type of hypocrisy that you were describing earlier. Members who were very complicit in what happened were now saying, well, please, can't we all just get along? Again, I don't personally have a whole lot of patience for it.
For years, we've heard complaints from the left about lies being told by right-wing media and right-wing politicians. Yesterday, there were complaints from Republicans about the cancel culture, which some liberals are against as well. But there is a strain of that, no question, in society. And that we heard complaints from Republicans about the censorship of the right by left-wing media, and that's aimed at Facebook and Twitter for taking Donald Trump off their platforms and for the shutting down of Parler, essentially. You cannot yell fire in a crowded theater unless there is a fire, period. End of comment. So is shutting down insightful rhetoric from the president or anyone else on a private platform, a commercially owned private platform, is that censorship from the left or from the right, Dr. Hebelig?
Promotion of violence is not protected as free speech. Likewise, the First Amendment protections of free speech are aimed at government behavior. We can argue whether private companies should enforce speech codes or things like that, but they clearly have the legal right to do it. I think most people do not object to those companies trying to prevent misinformation or to stop violence and threats. I think what most people are concerned about is that, what are the rules, what are the lines, and that those rules and lines be applied consistently, regardless of the point of view that's being expressed by the people. And so there's certainly movement both on the right and the left to try to figure out how to hold those large media conglomerates accountable and to figure out what the rules should be. Those discussions have been going on for a number of years, and we haven't come to any type of consensus. But I certainly think that that's an appropriate topic of discussion going forward.
Polling shows that 55%, I think that's the figure, of Americans agree with what happened in Congress yesterday. They agree with the impeachment. And had the president not been impeached prior to this, they believe that this would certainly have been an unquestionable impeachable offense. But the fact is, he was impeached prior to this. And he's been, as Republicans said consistently yesterday, the president has acted and spoken pretty much the same way for the past 4 years. And they argued that this impeachment was an attempt to punish him for the last 4 years of his unfiltered style of speaking. And so they asked, why now, in the final hours, are we trying to do this? Does that argument, Eric, hold water?
No, but in some senses, yes, his incitement to violence is not something he did just last week. It's been a consistent theme of his presidency and even his campaign in 2016. You could say that those that consistent 5 years of incitement finally had its clearest effect last Wednesday, but I don't think it was just about that incitement. It was also about his asking the vice president to engage in unconstitutional activity by overturning the results of the states. It was also about his failure to speak out on Wednesday and get his reporters or his supporters to back off and stand down or to aid the rescue of members of Congress. It was also about calling a Georgia election official and asking him to find votes. It's not just, again, part of the political strategy is to say, well, he said this one thing and that's really not incitement, or he said things before, and to obfuscate the fact that there's a much larger pattern going on here. And that's the pattern of behavior that we should push back against, regardless of whether this particular incident meets a legal definition of incitement.
Susan, now you wanted to comment on this.
I think when we look back, I think we look back and we've had 4 years of that's your truth, this is our truth. Alternate facts. I think that you look at misinformation, and that's been going on for 4 or 5 years if you consider the behavior of Trump before he received the nomination. It's sad to think that we can't change, if you mentioned cancer culture, if we can't change hearts and minds, maybe we can change some of the rhetoric. And I think that taking away Trump's megaphone is a start to that. And if you look back, and I just remembered, I don't have the details of when it was or where it was, but for Trump to say at some rallies, when someone is disruptive, he goes, the good old days, we would carry that person out on a stretcher. Mm-hmm. These are not, it's not an isolated incident. And people can tell when Trump is off script or on script. And I think that the silencing of Trump, or however long it takes, Trump will find a way to get a message out. But for now, in this context, as heated as things are, I think it was necessary, because I think that words matter and you can incite someone. If you look at Trump's lingo, build the wall, stop the steal, lock her up. If you repeat something, it's very portable for people to say, yeah, lock her up. Yeah, stop the steal. And I think that his language and his action at rallies proves that you have to do something to stop that insurrection, not for every Republican, for sure. But some of the extremists, they want to hear certain things and they want to be activated.
Yeah, Donald Trump is a salesman.
Again, as Asher said about something else, that's a whole new show.
Donald Trump is a salesman, and that's what got him to where he is. And salespeople know that if you repeat something often enough, that's when people start to believe it. It's been said several thousand times now, so it must be true. And I think that's what we saw, what we've been seeing here. Another argument that was made yesterday by Republicans, Asher, during the impeachment debate, is that impeaching the president may further incite violence by these extremist groups. And we know there are serious, credible threats for future violence. In fact, this weekend and on Inauguration Day around the Capitol building and throughout Washington, D.C., and at every single capital of every state in the United States. Could those pushing impeachment be accused of inciting violence? Or is this something completely different? You can't kowtow to terrorists.
I take the latter view. I do think it's one extraordinary thing about this situation is that the threat to public safety has not gone away. In fact, and it may have even intensified as we look ahead to inauguration. And of course, that's hanging over all of this. But imagine if after September 11th, the response of our public officials would be, well, we can't go after the terrorists because then they might attack us again. That's the kind of logic you've heard. And I just think we've got to rise above that. We've got to prepare, to plan, to protect the American people, but also to hold people accountable for what they've done.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy yesterday said the president, this is a quote, the president bears responsibility for the attack on Congress. He should have immediately condemned it. And he finally admitted that Joe Biden would become president next week because, quote, he won the election, end quote. So instead of impeachment, he recommended censure and an investigation and said that impeachment would only serve to further divide the country. I'm not sure who to ask this of. Eric, what would censure accomplish?
Censure would just put Congress on record to say they don't approve of this behavior. And censure, I served in the House of Representatives on a staff of a member of Congress from Ohio during the Clinton impeachment. And censure was certainly brought up then. Democrats saying, well, we don't approve of the president's behavior, but we don't think it fits a standard of high crime and misdemeanor for impeachment. And the Republican leadership at the time said, no, the only constitutional option is impeachment. You know, Democrats are just looking for a way to wiggle out of this. You got to vote for impeachment or nothing. Now it's Republicans that are arguing censure needs to be the option, that impeachment is divisive. So, you know, this fits for me with what I was saying earlier. If you can't defend the behavior, you shift to arguing about something else. I don't think it matters very much whether you censure or you impeach in this instance. That's not really what the argument should be about. It should be about, is this a behavior that we want to incentivize, or do we want to punish it?
One of the reasons for the urgency of this impeachment and potential conviction in the Senate prior to Inauguration Day would be so that the president would no longer have the power to pardon himself, members of his family, fellow supporters, and even the insurrectionists. He could still do that between now and next Wednesday at noon. How big of a concern, Susan, should that be? And if he were to pardon himself, would that create a constitutional crisis?
Well, I'm not a legal scholar, but in the Washington Post yesterday, I believe, some scholars were saying in the Constitution, it says, except in the case of impeachment. And the speculation about pardoning himself, and he has brought that up. That's prior to the incitement of insurrection and the impeachment. The pardon of, someone that is in his administration, the pardon of members of his family before they were charged with anything. He was playing fast and loose then. I doubt seriously that he could pardon the insurrectionist. We have names, we have faces.
So what? You're breaking up. But let me just jump in here and ask you, what? Because the presidential pardon power is broad, vast, unbridled.
It is. But I think that there is some nuance. Just as when we had the president, there was debate about what do we mean by emergency powers? Because this has given, the Trump presidency has given a lot of people the chance to re-examine the Constitution and see what we mean. And at some point when the president said, I'm president, I can do anything I want. Mm-hmm. It's not true, but I think it gave us time to pause and say, what did we mean by that? How can we read between the lines? Can I jump in and say one more thing?
Very quickly.
Censure is more like bad boy, you know, and impeachment is serious and big. And so I think he wanted a legacy. Trump's got a legacy.
Very quickly, because I only have less than a minute left, and that is the president's approval rating stands at only 33%. President-elect Biden wants to be a uniter. But there are a significant number of citizens who view him as illegitimate. Do any of you see a way forward? I only have 30 seconds. Asher.
Get the work done. Focus on, get past this impeachment. Focus on COVID relief, economic recovery, and let the results speak for themselves.
Eric.
I agree.
Susan.
I think it's going to be difficult because we want bipartisan and unity, but we also want values. And I think people are going to speak.
Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Eric Heberling from UNC Charlotte, and Asher Hildebrand from the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University in these amazing times. Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.